The Iowa Democratic caucuses have come to an end, but we have no winner thanks to inconsistencies from an app.
The warning signs were there all along. They were raised all along. And unfortunately for the Democratic Party, all those predictions came true.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and today on The Takeaway for February 4th, we take a look at how the caucus process broke down. Also on the show, we'll talk about NFL players and how many of them could be suffering from CTE.
You wouldn't know an NFL player today who doesn't personally know somebody who's been diagnosed with the disease, because we've now diagnosed well over 100 cases of this.
Plus, we speak to Radiolab's Latif Nasser about his encounter with a Guantanamo Bay detainee who shares his name.
The more I found out about him, that he was this kind of monster to judge from these documents, just was a shock. And I just needed to know more.
All right, a lot to get to, but we start in Iowa.
So listen, it is too close to call, so I'm just gonna tell you what I do know.
So many questions about why things seem to have gone so wrong.
Some party officials say mobile app reporting issues caused the problem, so results are being hand-checked.
Anytime you launch a big, important process like this and you're not able to put results forward, it's a big failure.
They're doing quality control, looking for possible discrepancies.
We saw a lot of the campaigns really trying to spin the night in their favor.
We brought together an extraordinary coalition of Americans, progressives, moderates, and that good number of what we like to call future former Republicans.
Let's head to New Hampshire. Thank you, Iowa. I love you.
It's our lives. Gang, gang, it's our lives, America.
Our union is stronger than Donald Trump.
The first state in the country has voted. Today marks the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
This is well beyond our party. This is about ending an era of, ending an era, God willing.
After months of campaigning, the Iowa caucuses are finally over. Well, almost over. The Iowa Democratic Party says that due to inconsistencies in data, the results are delayed but could be released later today. Even with no results, many of the candidates believe they performed well, some even claiming victory before making their way to New Hampshire. So let's talk about it. Joining me from Iowa is Amy Walter, host of Politics with Amy Walter here on The Takeaway every Friday, and national editor of the Cook Political Report. So glad to have you on the line from Iowa, Amy.
Well, I am very glad to be here, although it's still very cold here.
Okay, so more than a few observers are calling this a debacle for Democrats. Does it feel that way to you?
Oh my gosh, yes. It's sort of beyond a debacle. This process that Democrats tinkered with, this caucus process, to be sure, it's already a somewhat complicated, anarchic, confusing process where people are publicly announcing who they're voting for in a community center or gym or church basement, and then counting by hand the other people who are voting for that candidate, and those numbers get sent into the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, and numbers are tabulated, results go out, and we move on. The fact that it is so opaque, and really considering the stakes for this process, right? The winner here can go on, claim victory, use that momentum in many cases to go on to win the nomination. The fact that this process now got more complicated by new rules meant that it is even more difficult to figure out what the actual numbers on election night looked like. And it may take days or more to clean it up.
Was there a moment yesterday when you suddenly realized that this was just a huge mess?
Yes, I think it was when we started to get reports that people who are in charge of each one of these precincts were trying to load an app where all the information was going to go, and then that app would go directly to the Democratic headquarters, was not working, that the phone lines that were set up as a backup also were kind of a mess. And we had heard reports, too, of just how within the rooms there was confusion about how the new rules were going to work. And so, you know, look, the fact that by 9 o'clock, 9:30 Central Time, and we still had no official results from any precincts was a really, really bad sign.
And regarding this new app that supposedly imploded, let me just read a brief excerpt from a New York Times article this morning titled, "A System-Wide Disaster, How the Iowa Caucuses Melted Down." Appropriately enough, it wasn't so much that the new app that the Iowa Democratic Party had planned to use to report its caucus results didn't work. It was that people were struggling to even log in or download it in the first place. I mean, this just seems to be kind of riddled with poor preparation and just an absolute lack of foresight. Am I right?
Yeah. And look, there had been questions from the very beginning from reporters, from party officials. We were there. Politics with Amy Walter team was here about a week and a half ago. We sat down with the Democratic Party chairman, asked him a lot of the questions that are being raised now about how this process is going to work and is it going to be smooth and how are you going to make sure and ensure that the results are fair and accurate. And, well, here we are. Look, I think that the challenge all along has been for Iowa to keep its first in the process status. They cannot have a traditional primary. That is in literally the New Hampshire law that they go first. So they have sort of jerry-rigged a process that looks like a primary, but it's technically not a primary, so they get the status. Well, it worked, and it worked until it didn't work any longer. And the more attention that Iowa has gotten, the more questions got raised by reporters, candidates, and others about this caucus process. And so they tried to amend this, make it look fairer, more open. And again, one of the other rules that is sort of primary-like was to say, we're going to report not just how many delegates a candidate got, but for the very first time, how many actual votes they got. Think of it as the difference between the popular vote and the electoral college vote, so that one candidate literally could claim they got the most votes, even though another candidate won the most delegates. And I think that made it even more difficult to handle. And Arun, you raised something that's also really important. These precincts, there are about 1,700 of them, they are not run by officials. This is not secretaries of state or election registrars who do this for a living. These are volunteers with the party who do this once every 4 years. So it makes it incredibly difficult to streamline this process. And think, too, of the kinds of places that you will be dealing with. A crowded caucus in a bigger city like Des Moines, or one where you may have internet issues out in rural Iowa. And so the warning signs were there all along. They were raised all along. And unfortunately for the Democratic Party, all those predictions came true.
What has the Iowa Democratic Party said following all this?
Yeah, well, at about 1 o'clock in the morning Central Time, they had a press call, which essentially clocked in at about 2 minutes, no questions. And essentially they said, we're working through this. We're going to make sure we get this right. We're double and triple checking. And we're going to have numbers out sometime today, which is Tuesday. But it's really unclear what that will look like. If you go back to 2012, there was something similar to this on the Republican side. But at least at that point, Mitt Romney had been declared the winner by 34 votes at about 1:30 in the morning on caucus night in 2012. But questions were raised about some votes from certain precincts. They did an autopsy and a recount. And something like 2 weeks later, Rick Santorum was declared the winner. But by then, the circus had moved on. Mm. We were way beyond Iowa. And so I think what is ultimately going to happen is that New Hampshire will now get to be not just the first primary state, but will literally be the kickoff. And it's almost like we're starting from scratch in New Hampshire. And then from there, we move to the next process, which is Nevada.
So this morning at about 4:45, I wake up, look at my phone,
And the first thing I think when I see this whole mess playing out is, oh, was this Russia?
Mm-hmm. You are raising a really important point, and I think we should all be very sobered by this. I mean, we can look at this and say the caucus process is already so confusing, and, you know, don't read too much into this. But you can also look at this as a warning for what we can expect going into 2020 campaign, that with every questionable result on election night, there are going to be people tweeting things. There are going to be conspiracy theories lurking around the internet. There are going to be stories of, well, I was at a precinct in Wisconsin, and you know what happened? I saw 15 people illegally come and vote, right?
Yeah.
And so if where we are right now is the process isn't trusted, it's easy to sow discontent and conspiracies through social media. The media is, of course, been undermined in recent years as sort of the arbiter of all of this. It is definitely a very dangerous moment that we're in. And the idea that everyone will walk away on election night saying, okay, well, we had a good election, nice game, shake hands, get off the field, that seems really hard to believe, especially if we expect, as I do, that we're going to have another very, very close election in 2020 as we did in 2016.
And to the points that you've been raising, let's hear a voice message from one caucus goer in Iowa. Here's what he said his experience was like yesterday.
My name is Daniel Frana. I am a resident of Iowa City. So initially, I felt very hopeful. I was very happy with the results of our caucus. I was very proud to be a part of the democratic process. But then when I saw that the results of the caucus were in contest, it made me very upset because I feel like it's a way to try to make the whole thing feel illegitimate.
Illegitimate is mm-hmm. Daniel's a sentiment, sort of, do you think he's representative of other people in Iowa?
Yeah, other people in Iowa and, of course, across the country. And the media narrative about what a disaster it was and getting more calls from caucus goers like Daniel is only going to feed into this concern. And so if I were a state election official, I would be doing absolutely everything in my power right now to, number one, ensure the security and sanctity of the voting process, but also to be open and transparent with the media right now about what it is they are doing and ensuring that they will do on election night or on their primary nights, you know, to keep the process from falling into question. And look, nothing else is like the Iowa caucus. So this is a uniquely challenging environment, to put it nicely, to get accurate results, especially when you put it under the microscope. I mean, the closer you look at the caucus, the more you see that this is really just rife with so many problems. But that doesn't mean that other states shouldn't take this as a very big warning sign for how easy it is when people don't have information to fill that vacuum with conspiracies, with rumor, and those things spread very, very quickly.
Amy Walter is the host of Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway and national editor of the Cook Political Report. Amy, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
This Super Bowl Sunday marked the end of another NFL season, but even as the league enters its offseason, it remains mired in controversy over the long-term health of its players. CTE, that's chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is often associated with repeated head injuries from football. For now, there is no reliable technology to detect CTE in the living. It can only be fully diagnosed after someone dies. It was only after the death of former New England Patriot Aaron Hernandez that his own CTE was confirmed. And a new documentary renews questions about the link between his disease and his conviction for murdering a friend.
I spoke with Chris Nowinski about the state of the science around CTE today. He's CEO and co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation, co-founder of the Boston University CTE Center, and is a former WWE wrestler. I asked him to start out by giving us a clear definition.
CTE is a neurodegenerative brain disease that evidence supports is caused by repeated brain trauma. It starts as small lesions in the cortex and then spreads even after you stop getting hit in the head, and causes symptoms that include problems with mood, behavior, and cognition.
What makes it so hard to diagnose?
We just haven't studied the disease as long as we have similar diseases like Alzheimer's disease. We still can't diagnose Alzheimer's disease in life with 100% accuracy, but we have followed people who we believe have Alzheimer's till they passed away and looked at their brains and confirmed that was the cause of their symptoms. And scientists have developed criteria based on that. And we just need to do the work to develop CT criteria for living people, and then we'll be able to diagnose it during life.
Okay, so this is an area of research that is really growing a lot right now. You're the co-founder of the Boston University CTE Lab. Tell me how the lab studies CTE.
Sure. The Boston University CTE Center studies CTE in multiple ways. It started as a brain bank, and so we have 834 brains of former athletes and veterans and other people exposed to repetitive brain trauma, and we're trying to understand what the disease looks like and how we can identify ways we might be able to identify it in living people and treat it. We also have a clinical research arm that is working on the largest studies in the U.S. right now in trying to study former football players, former soccer players, and others exposed to repeated brain trauma and learn how to diagnose them while in life with the goal of eventually being able to offer them effective treatments. We also have a basic sciences arm that's trying to understand the beginnings of this disease and have published multiple animal models of CTE.
So you house hundreds of brains, many of them of football players. Is this something that is becoming increasingly common for people to, I guess, donate their brains to your center, much more common than it might have been 5 or 10 years ago?
It is becoming much more common for former athletes and veterans to donate their brain to our research. To give a window into how much this has changed over time, when we started our center in 2008, we were the first research center in the world dedicated to CTE. We'd known about CTE for about 100 years, but only 45 cases had been confirmed worldwide and published in the literature. Since then, we've been getting increasing numbers of brain donations, starting from about 10 a year to last year, about 170. And interestingly, in our first 8 years, we got 10% of former NFL players that passed away during that window of time. In the last 4 years, we've gotten more than 1 in 3 brains of NFL players who've passed away. That'll give us an incredible window into that population.
Yeah. So are there particular cases or stories that came out that really kind of prompted players to take this seriously?
There's no shortage of former NFL players' stories that have caught the attention of various groups. And you probably wouldn't know an NFL player today who doesn't personally know somebody who's been diagnosed with the disease, because we've now diagnosed well over 100 cases of this. Dave Duerson in 2011 was a well-known player who caught a lot of people's attention because he was so successful after his two-time Super Bowl career in the NFL, playing for the Chicago Bears and New York Giants. In his mid-40s, was on the top of the world, Board of Trustees in Notre Dame, and then had a very steep and severe decline, both in his behavior, becoming violent with his wife and children, his business dealings, and going into bankruptcy. And he died by suicide at age 50 by shooting himself actually in the chest and leaving a note asking for his brain to be studied. And I feel like that was a moment that really got everyone's attention because he was so well-respected.
How does all of this information and the dark side of football, if you will, affect your experience of watching football?
So I played football. I was an all-Ivy defensive tackle at Harvard University. And, you know, I can still support parts of football, and especially those parts where it's adults who are informed of the consequences choosing to play the game. But it's also difficult to watch knowing how many former athletes are struggling from those thousands of hits to the head. And for me, what I get stuck on is the idea that all of us chose to play that game when we were children. Literally, everybody who plays football starts before they're 18 years old. Most people start before they're 14 years old. And we could not have understood what we were exposing ourselves to at that age. And so it's tough to watch. But then again, you know, I'm also a former WWE professional wrestler, so I'm not against adults doing a dangerous job if they want to provide for their family. But we do have to think about CTE, because this is a disease that's entirely preventable. This is a disease that if you do not get hit in the head, you are not going to suffer. This is a disease, if you get one concussion, you're not going to suffer. It's this extreme brain trauma that we're suddenly exposing ourselves to in our culture, where people are getting hit in the head thousands of times a year as a matter of course, as a matter of growing up, as a matter of contact sports. And it turns out your brain doesn't like that. And so we've got to get on top of this quickly.
Is your message getting through to parents, to people who might have kids who want to play peewee?
The message is getting out there. You know, there's no more heading in soccer before age 11. There's no more checking ice hockey till age 13. Some sports have embraced this. We're pushing hard on football because they're still recruiting your children at 5 years old to play tackle. And we don't recommend playing tackle football before high school. What's concerning about how the information is getting out there is that there's very clear evidence now that in places of high education, fewer kids are playing collision and contact sports as children. In places of lower education, that's not happening. And so the most vulnerable kids are getting exposed to more brain trauma than everybody else. And that doesn't bode well for, you know, your future ability to think and to work and to achieve.
Thanks to a Netflix series, Aaron Hernandez is back in news. Is there a demonstrated link between CTE and violence?
We haven't yet published a strong link between CTE and violence. That said, in participating in interviews with all of our families who've been diagnosed and seeing that data, a lot of families have a history of a dad or a son who was never violent and then became violent over time, and it appeared to correlate with the progression of CTE affecting parts of the brain that would affect violence. You know, you see the amygdala becomes affected, which controls fight or flight. You see the frontal lobe become damaged. And so you combine an amygdala that's damaged with a frontal lobe that's damaged, and you might have paranoid, violent, impulsive behaviors that usually would have not occurred. So I believe that it's fair to say that in time, the link between CT and violent, aggressive behavior will become stronger. We just need to do the work.
I've been speaking with Chris Nowinski, CEO and co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation and co-founder of Boston University CTE Center. Thank you so much for joining us, Chris.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Every memory you think you have of the past,
the house you grew up in, your first kiss,
it's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
For this next story, I want you to meet Latif Nasser. He's a reporter and the director of research for the long-running program and podcast Radiolab, produced here at WNYC Studios. And this story begins on an average day in January of 2017.
I was at work. I was procrastinating. I was looking at Twitter, and I saw a tweet that I thought was about me, and it was not. It was about this other guy who was detainee 244 at Guantanamo Bay.
Abdul Latif Nasser, same name, same spelling, different pronunciation.
I'm Latif, he's Latif.
And very different life trajectories.
The more I found out about him, you know, this government case about him that they outline in these leaked documents, that he's, you know, Al-Qaeda's top explosives expert, that he was this kind of monster to judge from these documents, just was a shock. And I just needed to know more.
Latif was supposed to be cleared and released from Guantanamo in 2016. And at the last moment, he wasn't. So Latif and his colleagues at Radiolab took it on, investigating Latif's case over the course of 3 years, trying to find out why he was at Guantanamo in the first place and why his release was stopped short.
Well, at first, it was just the circumstances of the case. It was just a really interesting case. So the government laid out this like pretty damning list of, in these leaked documents, this pretty damning list of things that they said he did. And then I talked to his lawyer, who said basically all of that was false, that he was never in Al-Qaeda. He didn't have a relationship with Osama bin Laden, you know, none of these things. I sat down with Latif Nasser to talk about this story, which has become the subject of a new 6-part series of episodes from Radiolab called The Other Latif. The case was just so stark. There was the blackest black version of him. There was the whitest white version of him, that he was like in Afghanistan to do charity type work, you know, in wrong place, wrong time. So I had these like the blackest black and the whitest white. And I was like, there's no hint of gray in between here. Something, this is a story. I need to follow. I need to investigate. And as I did, it became even more than that. It became this thing that actually felt weirdly personal. That name coincidence, that feeling that I initially had of like, is this tweet about me? That feeling, so much of those internal questions, that life trajectory that this guy followed, like I could see myself in, and I could try to sort of imagine my way into, and these pivotal moments in his life that weirdly echoed pivotal moments in my life, and it became this much more personal story.
I mean, for a lot of Americans, Guantanamo is kind of this forgotten place. What do you think people need to know about Guantanamo that they probably don't?
Most people think it's closed, actually, I think. I think Obama made such a big deal about closing it without actually closing it that I think, like, even I kind of had this vague sense in my head. I was like, oh, that place still exists when I heard about it. I think the fact that it still exists, I think one thing that people ought to know is that not only are there still 40 guys there, many of whom have never, not only have they not had trials, they've not had charges laid against them, including this guy, Abdul Latif Nasser, never had charges laid against him formally. But in addition to that, I think the thing that makes a lot of people, including my mouth, drop is the cost of it. So if you take a supermax prisoner in the United States, just guess, how much on average would a supermax prisoner cost?
$100,000 or $200,000 a year.
Yeah, so it's less than $100,000, okay? For a Guantanamo detainee per year, one detainee per year is $13 million of your tax money. That's a lot of money. And for each one of these guys, especially guys that, like in the case of this guy, Abdul Latif Nasser, and this is the other thing that just pulled me to his story, during the waning days of the Obama administration, this guy was cleared for transfer back to his home in Casablanca, Morocco. The government, 6 different agencies of the government at very high levels, they looked over this guy's case and they said, we don't need to be keeping this guy anymore. He is not a continuing threat to the United States. He should go home.
Are there a lot of other people like him who have been cleared?
He's one of 5 who have been cleared this same way. So he is sort of on paper, he's cleared. There was supposed to be this transfer back to his home, but basically because of stuff I've been reporting out, it's a kind of very dramatic story about bureaucracy and paperwork. The transfer, the communications between the U.S. government and Morocco broke down. Finally, they got an acknowledgement, but it was a few days too late. And basically, the Obama administration left, the Trump administration rolled in. This guy who is right on the cusp of getting onto a plane going all the way to Morocco, the Trump administration said, no, we're not going to do it. So now he is sort of stuck there. He's sitting there, cleared for transfer on paper, home, effectively no change in his life. And he's sitting there costing us all $13 million a year.
I mean, what is it costing him in terms of what is his experience like?
Yeah, that kind of a promise. Imagine this guy, he's been there since 2002. In 2016, and according to his lawyers, he's said many times, bring on a trial. Like, I would like to have a trial. Please try me fairly. We have not given him that trial. Then finally, when he did get the closest thing he had to a trial, which was this kind of parole board type hearing in 2016 where he got cleared, he passed it. He won his clearance. And then they told him, his lawyer told him, that it would just be a matter of, you know, days or weeks or whatever it was for him to be back on his home soil with his family. And then basically they had to come back to him and say, hey, you're going to be here for at least another 4 years, maybe more than that. We don't know.
What is his life like inside?
He has some degree of freedom. There were times kind of tracing his life. There were long stretches where he was in solitary confinement, where he was, you can parse the definition, but where I would argue he was tortured. Now he I do not believe he's being tortured anymore. He lives in a kind of a sort of a communal sort of a cell block where he's not confined to a cell. He can sort of walk around, read certain books that have been allowed to him. Weirdly, the only news he can watch is Russia Today. But basically, he's in stasis. And he, from his lawyer, I've learned, he wants to have a family. There's many things that he wants to do that he feels like he's not been able to do. And so one detail that I learned from his lawyer is that one of the things he does is he reads like self-help books and also like family books, like how to be a better parent and stuff like that. But he's a single man. He has this fantasy of getting out, having a family, but he just can't do it.
I mean, you almost kind of wonder how much just the value of having a fantasy when you are trapped inside a place for 18 years.
One of the lawyers I talked to said, and this is true in a number of places, not just Guantanamo, that yeah, that the most valuable commodity there is hope, but it's so often dashed that it's the hardest thing to hold on to.
Did you encounter him or meet him?
No journalist has ever interviewed a detainee at Guantanamo Bay while they were still a detainee at Guantanamo Bay. So I am not allowed, which is made for a very challenging, I mean, this whole story is in a way a real journalistic challenge. Like how do you make this is a 6-episode podcast, investigative type series, like without the main character's voice. It's been one of the biggest reporting challenges of my whole life.
So this is like Sinatra has a cold.
Yeah, or missing Richard Simmons kind of thing. Exactly the same thing. Right.
I mean, what have you learned without meeting your subject? What's he like?
I mean, I can tell you personality-wise, which is like one of the things when you learn that you have a doppelganger. I don't know if there are any Arun Vengopals.
Oh, there's so many, actually. That's the problem.
Really?
Once you get on Facebook.
This guy, he's an older guy. He's a quiet guy. He's a nerdy guy. He likes science. He's been at Guantanamo so long, he's taught himself English there. I don't know. It's so hard to judge because you get this portrait from the government documents and from these sort of dossiers about him that make him look one way. You get a portrait from his lawyers that make him look a different way. And it's so hard to try to triangulate. Like, where's the real person there?
Did you find things that the government has argued that you found to be legit?
Yeah. There are moments where I have found independent sources that are not from the government that have been somewhat damning. Sometimes it feels like his lawyer is spinning me as much as the government is, you know? And I've also found a whole bunch of really exculpatory things, things that make him look a lot less bad than the government thinks he is. So the whole process of reporting this, and I hope the whole process of listening to the series is just, it's like whiplash. Like you're just going back and forth. This guy, all of a sudden he looks like, he really does look like the worst of the worst. All of a sudden he really does look like he was just had the worst of the worst luck.
There's an interesting anecdote about the music they used in the torture sessions in Guantanamo and the parallels with your own personal life. Tell me about the Red Hot Chili Peppers and your thoughts on the so-called torture playlist.
Yeah, so one of the techniques that was used on this detainee, Abdul Latif Nasser, was kind of sensory overload, that they would play, they would make noise, they would play music really loud throughout the, you know, for extended periods of time, keep lights on, things like that. Another journalist had FOIA'd the list, basically the playlist, like the songs that they were using, and there was a lot, but one caught my eye on there, which was, there was a Red Hot Chili Peppers song, and why this was so eerie to me was that when I left home to go to school, I lived in a dorm and I love the Red Hot Chili Peppers and I would just play their music so loud and my dorm mates would always complain about how loud I would play the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And then I was like kind of thinking about it and I was like, that was the early 2000s when that happened and that there may have been a moment, and there's no way to know for sure or when, but there may have been a moment when I was blasting Red Hot Chili Peppers in my dorm room and this guy was being blasted at the same music, the same song. And that just gave me chills, just that it was something that I did for pleasure and that it was something that he would derive pain from. There's something just so eerie about that connection. I just couldn't shake it.
I want to play a quick clip from the first episode. This is Shelby Sullivan Bennis, who represents Abdul Latif Nasser. In this clip, she's describing the moment when she received really important news regarding him.
I was meeting up with a bunch of old friends, and everyone had just sat down and placed drink and like appetizer orders. And I get this phone call from my co-counsel, Tom Durkin, and I instantly walked outside without a coat. It was freezing. So I'm standing outside the Applebee's, and Tom says, the notice didn't go in, and he's not going home. And I just sunk to the ground. Merry Christmas.
So Latif, walk us through what she's talking about here.
This is the moment when this lawyer finds out that even though she worked so hard with this man to win this clearance at this parole board type hearing, to win this guy's basically his freedom, his right to go home, they won that. But then basically the paperwork got messed up and the notice didn't get sent in on time to, you know, to call the plane to put this guy on it. That basically, despite having put in all this work, it all just got undone. He's going to stay there. And since the Trump administration was coming into power, they had already made very clear, let's not let any more of these guys out of Gitmo. So she knew that this paperwork snafu was much more than a paperwork snafu. It actually meant 4 years of this guy's life, maybe 8 years, maybe who knows how much longer than that.
What is the message that is conveyed by the U.S. to the world when it can operate one or more facilities that hold people who haven't done what the U.S. says they've done and where they don't even intend to try them? I guess, what do you think that message is?
I mean, I think one of the things that sort of coincidentally happened was, as I've been reporting the story, I was basically in the final stages of becoming a citizen myself. And so, I'd be like studying for the citizenship test or something, and I would be thinking about this story and those questions that I'm being asked about this like civics test that I'm taking about these fundamental values of this country and what we all sign up for and stand for. You look at Guantanamo and it does seem that it's just there's a mismatch here, that a lot of the things that we believe in, due process, the rule of law, the, you know, life, liberty, all that kind of stuff, it seems like in this case, in this particular spot, we purposefully made a place that was, as it's called, the legal equivalent of outer space where those things don't apply.
When you say purposefully, do you think that it's the intent of the United States to convey a message that we can and will do what we want to?
Yeah, and I think it was very purposeful in the sense that it came shortly after 9/11. It came at this moment where, you know, where American government officials felt that gloves need to come off. This is an unprecedented thing that has happened, and we need to respond in this unprecedented way. We need to really it's no time to be, you know, precious about rights and values, you know, that we all agree on. All bets are off. We're going to do whatever it takes. And what now it feels like in hindsight, and there were even some people who were saying it at the time, like we really turned our back on what makes us us.
Latif Nasser is Radiolab's Director of Research. The first episode of The Other Latif is out today. Latif, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Arun.
So that fascinating story came from someone finding they shared a name with someone very unexpected. Has that ever happened in your life?
Hello, my name is Vinca Valdivia. I'm calling from San Diego, California. My first name is very unique, and I'm normally only used to hearing it in reference to myself or my mother, whom I'm named after. But one time when I was in court, I ran into a woman who had my same name, and I was very surprised to find out that she was also from my country of origin, which is Chile. When I mentioned it to my mother, she said that in her work as a midwife, in Chile back then, midwives delivered babies in hospitals unless there were any complications, at which point the doctors would be brought in. So many women for whom she was present at their birth ended up naming their daughters after my mother because they were so grateful for her help. It's such a great story that I would never have found out about unless I had run into that woman.
Thanks so much for sharing, Dinka. And thanks to all of you for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway.